Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Lauren Wolf, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the writer Craig Burnet. Craig Burnet has worked a range of professional and menial occupations, from technical writer to bartender, carpenter to dishwasher, sailor to kennel cleaner. Most recently, he was an instructor of writing at Duquesne University. He's a veteran of the Navy and a graduate of Wayne State University in Detroit. He was the Jacob K. Javits Fellow at the University of Pittsburgh from 2002 to 2005, where he earned his MFA in creative writing. His work has been published in the Great Lakes Review, Creative Nonfiction, the Roanoke Review, Western Humanities Review, Dogwood, Gigantic Sequence, and the anthology Detroit Noir. His collection of stories, Your Life Idyllic, won the St. Lawrence Book Award and has just been released with Black Lawrence Press. He lives in Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Craig.
Hi, Lauren.
It's nice to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Yeah. Can you begin by reading us some work?
Sure, absolutely. This is from the opening story in my book. It's called Bender. Need a little bit of a backdrop here. It's a younger brother is driving an older brother to detox. Nate is the elder brother, and Bill is the younger brother. Bill is a recently retired Marine Corps officer. He's been preparing for a second career, but his plans have been on hold because of Nate's drinking. So he's moved back to Detroit for the purpose of getting his brother sober. And we start the scene with the two in a parking lot. Nate makes an audible humph as I put the car in drive. What? I ask, the Mercedes idling us along. That's my sign, he points out his window. Sign? That neon sign, he says, looking back at me. The pool hall. He nods towards the strip mall. That's my sign. Beyond the misaligned parking blocks and errant rubbish blowing through the lot, a long neon cue stick works across the front windows of Motor City Billiards. I've seen the sign before. This stretch of 8 miles is part of my commute from Grosse Pointe Farms to Chrysler's Warren Truck Plant. What do you mean, yours? I scan for an exit from the lot, find one, then glance back to the sign while angling towards the egress. What do you mean, what do I mean? Mine. I made it. You're a carpenter, a handyman. You mean you made the frame? He pulls another beer from the plastic binding. No. He cracks the top for a drink. Remember I told you I was doing side work after business dropped off? Vaguely. I told you I'd started working for Zimmerman's. Business went to hell after the financial collapse. Don't you blame this on the economy, Nathan. The business crashed because you crashed. You were drunk all the time. Either way, it was slow. I had that lawsuit pending. I was about to lose my license for good. I needed cash flow. Nate takes another drink. So I was reading want ads at the bar, and this guy asked me if I needed work. Said somebody quit and he needed a guy now. Zimmerman's does all the neon for Metro Signs. Metro Signs does everything you see around here, all Tri-County, really. It was close. I could walk or ride my bike. I said yes, so he told me to show up the next day. He had plenty of work. I went in and apprenticed pumping gas for the benders. I didn't break anything the first day, and pretty soon I was bending. Bending? Glass tube. It comes straight, and you have to bend it to make signs. Next, I was designing stuff. It all happened fast. I thought it was easy, but they were all impressed and stuff. I see an opening in traffic, but it's tight. I decide against it. There are a few cars coming, then another break. I give Nate's sign another look. It's full of implied motion. A series of synchronized neon tubes fires just so. The illusion is that we, the viewers, catch the stick in the final nanoseconds before its green tip impacts the white cue ball. The ball rockets across the windows to the other side of the double door entrance, strikes the black 8, and leaves the white cue in its place. My mind leaps to the next conclusion, that the 8 ball has passed through the wall, into the next building, a dry cleaner's, where it careens off suspended trolley racks, smashes dresses and slacks to the floor, upends rows of suits and gowns, and finally comes to rest in the back, next to the steam presses, and a Korean woman who smokes while leaning against the jamb of a metal door. This story fires over and over in 2-second intervals ad infinitum. There's an opening in traffic, so I pull out. I dial our speed in to catch all the lights. 48 miles an hour is the number. Nate says nothing. A silence sets over the drive. Nate points to another sign at the corner of Gratiot. We pass an enormous red fish, sharp, dangerous, and though this sign has no flashing bulb work to imply movement, the design of the lines connote bold and intentioned travel through the sea. It's a big fish, ocean-going, a stylized mahi, maybe an ahi, but it doesn't matter either way, since on the corner of 8 Mile and Gratiot, it's just a fish. Impressive. Any moron could see there's skill and artistry in Nate's signs. I make a fine-tune adjustment to the rear view. How come I didn't know any about this neon sign stuff? Because you always been busy. You fight the good fight, Billy. Joe Marine for America. For as long as I've known my brother, he's been pretty deadpan. Humor and sarcasm aren't his bag. He's straight-spoken and avoids innuendo. He doesn't cloud his speech with smart aleck. Until now. Leaves tumble from the side streets, blown hard onto 8 Mile by a crosswind. Nate adjusts the cheap plastic sunglasses he's been wearing since we left. Light is fading. The sun is nearing the tree line. I do not know this man. I can't access his logic. We inhabit different worlds. Nate points out a few more of his signs as we move west. Then he asks me cold to stop at a bar. For what? Bathroom, bro. It's pretty bad. You can't wait 10 minutes? Not a chance. Bi-County is on Shaner. Not a chance. He points to an upcoming plywood arrow, a beaten sign signaling a turn-in to a dirt lot. It's out front of a cinder block bar. I hit the blinker, slow, and make a right. I pull the Mercedes to the front of a windowless building. It's painted yellow with large black stenciling sprawled across the front. On the left side of a gray metal door is the word Chug. On the door itself, sandwiched between hyphens, is the letter A. On the adjacent wall, to the right, is the word Lugs. Before I can get into park, Nate bolts from the car with beer in hand. Chug-a-lugs, we have arrived. Nate drains most of the beer while jogging to the door. He whips the empty into the parking lot, where it rattles past a couple of railroad ties, and into the scrub of a vacant lot. I will fix that man. That's what I did for the Marine Corps. I upgraded the condition of things from hosed up to Bravo Zulu. I square away gear adrift. I fix. That's the present I'll give my mother. Fixing her eldest. I will teach that man about willpower and character and sacrifice. He is now my mission, and that man will get sober. When he is released from their routine, I will assume command of his continuing care. There will be no slack. Relapse is no longer an option. My mother, 78, in failing health, will die content. Then I can leave. Sell the house we just bought. Take whatever loss we take. Say goodbye, Rust Belt, and hello, Sun Belt. I'd like a contracting job so I can double dip my service retirement and a proper paycheck. I've earned it. I'll come back to bury Nate when he eventually goes, but otherwise, I'm through with this part of the world.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the writer Craig Bernay, reading from Your Life Idyllic. So what I really like about that story is this juxtaposition with this relationship between the brothers and this landscape that they're really reflecting on as they drive. So what draws you to anchoring the story in that way? Why is the landscape seems heavily focused on?
Most of my stories, 7 of the 9 stories in the book, are set in Detroit, in the Detroit metropolitan area. And I've just always found it to be, having grown up in around that area and then gone to school at Wayne State and just hanging around downtown, it's an eye-catching place with a lot of juxtaposition. I mean, you'll be standing next to a car with its window broken out while you're looking at the glass on the street and just thinking, like, wow, look at how beautiful the sun is catching the glass, and look at the Detroit Institute of the Arts in the background, and I should call somebody about this window. And it's a place of clashing and juxtaposition, and it's very old and very modern at the same time. So it's a good place to set your stories.
So do you feel that the relationship of the brothers in that story also is clashing in the same way that landscape clashes?
They're both equally clueless, and that's what the story goes to find out, is that neither of them have very much power.
But they're still sort of dependent on one another.
I think so. And that's what comes through in the story, is that these family bonds. And a number of the stories are that way. They deal with family members trying to deal with other family members' dysfunction.
Yeah, that's life, right?
Yeah, totally.
Is that, because you open the book with that piece. Mm-hmm. And why do you feel that's a good entry point for the reader? Why did you choose that piece as the beginning?
Everybody knows 8 Mile, mm-hmm. From Eminem's movie, and so the story is largely, it takes place on 8 Mile, the two brothers driving from one side of Detroit to the other. 8 Mile is an incredibly long strip of road that changes many times as you go along. So it's a long drive. To the other side of way over to the west side. So
you feel that's a good entry point?
Yeah, it's a nice. You see all these changes. You see different sort of architectural movements in Detroit. You see when it was a ranch house place. You see when it was a colonial place. You see when there was Tudors being built. You see strip malls. You see flea markets, strip clubs, for that matter. There's a whole bunch of stuff on 8 Mile. So it's somewhat representative of the vast swath that is the Detroit metropolitan area.
So how does that story, as the first story in the book, represent what's to come in the rest of the collection?
It's bleak.
Nothing wrong with that.
It's bleak. I've been told these stories are depressing. I don't find them that way. I find them very, very realistic. But, I guess that's what happens when you get into the hyper-realistic. It can seem really bleak. But most of my characters have, they haven't lost hope in any way. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's why I don't see these stories as bleak. These characters are holding on.
Right, and it's always a surprise of what a reader might think versus what you have thought while you were writing, you know. Can you read some more?
Sure, absolutely. This is an excerpt from the book called An Affliction of Starlings. Briefly, it's a divorced father who is doing his Sunday visitations with his daughter. She's a budding Francophile and much more an adult than he's used to, and is speaking English less and less to him and eating less and less. So this is the part of their morning routine where they're at breakfast. The daughter's name is Roxanne, Roxy for short. I work for one of Detroit's charter school initiatives. I'm the high school counselor. My buddy, who teaches wood and metal shop, made me a stained cherry plaque a few years ago. It has my name on it, right? But underneath, he fashioned the title, High School Consoler. I'm not sure if it was a mistake or intentional, but it seems the most apt description of what I do. Students, faculty, parents, staff, everyone seems to overlook the misspelling. Only my vice principal has made comment, then laughed herself from my office. I also teach on the adjunct faculty at Macomb Community College, intro to psych and psych 2 now and then. I have a limited license and I see patients as well, troubled teens, Monday, Wednesday, Thursday nights through St. John Outreach. My point is, I know kids. I know their problems, what's at issue, what's at stake. But with my daughter, It's like I looked too long at an eclipse. I can't see any longer. I study her a lot. I listen. I don't offer advice unless it's solicited. And still, with all that, I can't seem to get her any longer. We used to be so close, but now it's safest when I play the flat role of daddy from a few years ago. I bury all this knowing in my guts. Dad, I hear Roxy say a second time, I think. Sorry. I asked if we could skip the movie. Willa brings the check, sets it in front of me. She fills Roxy's cup a fourth time. And what would we do instead? DIA? We have to go as much as possible before the city, like, sells all the art. The city can't do that, I tell her. It's held in the public trust. You watch, Roxy says. The paintings will be the first to go. An old couple comes through the door, and instead of a wintry cold blast, they bring a temperate breeze with them. It's getting warmer with the sun aloft. There's a musk on the air, a discernible rot with last week's snow layer melted. Besides, I tell her, I already fandangoed the tickets last night. Fandangoed, she cries. Look at you go, techno boy. How about after? You said you wanted to shop for the trip. And after, I'm assuming we'll eat. Eat, eat, eat! What's with you and all the eating? God! She starts breaking her food into four different camps on the plate. It'll just be time to eat, that's all. She pushes her plate forward, then drops her head all the way until it hits the countertop with a thud. The man to my right looks over, but only looks back to his paper in response. Ripples dance on the surface of my coffee. I glance back to my daughter. Her once brown hair now dyed so dark that it takes the morning sun beaming in on her to reveal the deep scarlet highlights invisible until that moment. I like the red streaks, I say. But she lifts her arms and crosses them over the back of her head. She says something very French into the countertop. My parents are both Quebecois. Both stopped speaking French after moving from Quebec City to Buffalo. My father, a welder, eventually followed the trade to the auto industry in Detroit. This was the extent of his travels. He came from a line of trappers, but failed to master the wilderness. Factories saved him from starvation. My mother's people were transient folk, stevedores, mercenaries, and rail engineers. The Bougainvilles were strewn in every sea, buried on all continents. My parents were naturalized American citizens by the time I was growing up, but they frowned on the idea of cultural identity. Good guests assimilated. At least that's what my father thought. Aside from their clunky accents and the occasional slips for covert speech, French was dead in my parents, or at least for the most part. On rare occasions, my father would drink sherry. He'd nip from the glass while sitting at the kitchen table. He'd watch me watching television while he sorted through pocket change. Then he would send me off to bed at some point. I'd head to the second floor and he'd clomp down the wooden stairs into our unfinished basement. Later, my father's music, records from the basement, would wake me. Louder and louder, songs in his native tongue would travel through the ductwork and returns of our old brick home, carried on the currents of the furnace cycling on and off. He would sing along, his voice shabby and out of tune. That sad, singing bear howling from his cavern was a mystery to me. That was not the quiet fellow who sorted through pocket change, separating silver coins into coffee cans for the basement and alloys back into circulation. That was not the man always shutting off the television, the radio, the record player, or any burning light. I would head to the basement in the morning to find that bear, but Dad worked first shift and never missed a day. Only the albums remained, their maudlin covers depicting men of the wild, sullen folk clad in flannel, scarves, wool caps, and always at least one raccoon hat. They drank from flasks and enameled coffee pots teepeed over a fire. They played wooden pipes, makeshift drums, banjos strung with lament, it seemed. It was harder to catch my mother speaking French because it came without fanfare. When she did it, it was in calls to her family, her brother, an open ocean fisherman in British Columbia, or up to Quebec for her mother, who kept late hours as a radio operator on the St. Lawrence for the Canadian government. I knew my mother was speaking because it came with the smell of breads and pastries, as she always baked during these evolutions. I'd wait to sweets in the air, cinnamon or jams, then murmurs from the kitchen downstairs. I'd creep from my room to the stairway's edge, careful not to incite the wooden groans. Her chain smoking would overpower the finer aromas, but from my mother, French was enamoring. Beautiful husks of liaison fell from her alongside her speedy riffs of fluency. To me, it was like listening to the dizzying run of notes from my dad's jazz records. When I think of her now, it is never as the bag of bones fighting cancer until the end, but instead speaking in French while baking, using two ashtrays for one cigarette, one from the table and one by the oven, jockeying back and forth between checking the oven and sitting to listen, sipping red wine from a mason jar while turning the long phone cord like a jump rope with her free hand. The meager luminescence of the oven's overhead bulb bathes her progress in sepia while the exhaust fan drones a blanket to cover the entire home.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the writer Craig Bernay, reading from his collection, Your Life Idyllic. I really like the narrator of that piece. He's sort of whimsical and nostalgic and kind of speaks in these interesting metaphors. So when you're crafting a piece like that, do you have an idea of character before you begin, or do you start with a scene and let that take you? Where did that character, I guess, come from?
That's a great question, and I don't have a good answer. My characters take a long time to come into being. They're snippets, they're people I know, they're people I've met, just to get started. And then, the goal to me is always to create a character well enough that I can stop sort of pushing the narrative around, and I can drop back and start watching what these characters want to do and what they go, and I kind of follow them about and see what it is that develops.
Well, that's really interesting. So you surrender a lot.
After
crafting.
Yeah, there needs to be and that's why my revision process takes so long. I mean, some of these stories are really old. That mm-hmm. one is close to 12 years old.
Mm-hmm. So in that sense, then, do you answer all those questions that sort of a writer answers when they're creating a character, like, you know what they look like, you know what they carry in their pocket, those kind of crazy questions? Does it get that deep?
No, never that for me. I appreciate that, and I used to try to do that. I would try to know, like, people's familial histories, and I might even, like, write that, but I stopped doing that.
Yeah.
I just get enough to where I can follow them around. It doesn't take much, and when I do, and I get out of the way and stop steering the story, I'm surprised that Flannery O'Connor talks about that a lot, mm-hmm. about being surprised about what your characters do.
Right, and
that's
the
what
fun
I'm looking
part.
For. Yeah, totally.
Right, because you never know what's going to happen when you create these things. It's sort of like you give birth to these these beings, and it's really interesting.
It is.
Do you have some more work you can read?
I do. I've got another Detroit piece about a Detroit truck driver here. It's pretty short. It's called Home Free. The main character's name is Harvey. He drives an auto rig, and he's just picked up a load of Cadillacs. He's had an altercation, and so we join them in mid-altercation. There it was, tucked too tight between his trailer and a rusty Chevy Celebrity. Harvey saw a clean, pearl Volvo S40. The driver, a young man with sleeves rolled to his elbows and top button undone, spoke on a cellular while fidgeting at the instrument panel. Harvey moved to the driver's side door, but the man ignored him for an impressive amount of time. Harvey scanned the landscape while waiting. He could see the city to the south, the tubular Renaissance Center skyscraper, mirrored glass oddball towering above the more austere and modest buildings surrounding it. but the foreground looked more natural than urban, scrub grass and overgrowth made up large swaths of it. Lately, Harvey had sighted a herd of 25 to 30 deer roaming these near empty fields. City dwellers, these deer, unafraid of traffic, the bucks quick to charge small cars instead of run from them. Farther up Mount Elliot, past an array of crushed plastic bottles and flattened aluminum cans, some houses looked nice, quite habitable. But every third or fourth lot, where a house should be, was the husk of a dwelling instead, blackened by fire, or simply framing and roof parts, topping a pile of debris. Harvey looked back to the driver, who was still talking on his phone. He rapped the window with his wedding band. The man looked to be a paunchy adult version of the kid he may have been. College boy is what Harvey thought, and guessed him for an early 30s GM exec type. The driver powered his window down a smidge and looked at Harvey as if nothing were the matter. He covered the speaker of his cellular and asked, "Yeah." Harvey used a hand to support himself, then bent to the opening. "Something you want to tell me?" "Call you back," the driver said. He tossed his phone to the passenger seat. "Say what?" "Was there something you needed to tell me?" Harvey asked. The driver looked to his sun visor as if he'd tucked an answer up there. "Your horn," Harvey continued. "Way you was blowing it, I thought maybe there was some kind of emergency you needed to relay. You know, that's what a horn is for." The driver shifted in his seat, then pressed a switch on the dash. He looked at his lap, then up to Harvey. "Look, man," he said. And then, as if to convince Harvey of his sincerity, fully toggled down his window. "I'm just trying to loop back around and get onto 94. Harvey thumbed towards the freeway below them. "Freeway's right there, bub. You just gotta wait like everybody else. Then you'll be home free." Harvey crouched and got eye to eye with the driver. "You know how long I've been driving trucks?" he asked. The man shook his head and, using only his eyes, looked to his lap, then back up again. "More than 3 decades. A horn blew from a Lincoln town car, new to the situation and just pulling up behind the trouble." Harvey didn't break his stare. "That's my point, see? Patience." Harvey looked the boy hard in the eye until the driver turned his gaze. "Patience is what keeps guys like me from killing guys like you." "Look, man, I'm just..." "I know," Harvey interrupted. "You're just trying to get on the freeway." The driver's phone beeped, and he reached out of instinct to check it. When he did, Harvey put his hands to where the door met the roof line and gave the whole vehicle a hard shove, enough to jostle the car. The driver flared his stare back to Harvey. The young man was grinning with discomfort and shock. "I'll be up here trying to execute a left if you think of what you got to say to me." Harvey straightened his spine, then brushed the knees of his coveralls out of habit. He cast one more withering look into the Volvo. On his way back, he marveled at the 8 Cadillacs as he moved along his trailer. The gleam of paint, the glint in the rims, all those clean, greaseless underbodies. Harvey thought the contrast between the neighborhood, his ratty old trailer, and the new caddies would make a superb advertisement. Him, ratty, fresh from some scrap with some guy. The rig, ratty, stalled at an intersection on a cold November morning. Detroit, ratty in the background, and all the nearby vegetation utterly brown. But the cars on the trailer would be brilliant in the pale summer glimmer.
The writing of Craig Bernay. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for asking me to be here. It's great.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jam Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 FM.